who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past February fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
Hi, this is David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio, and I want to let you know AR has a new time slot on KPFK. Tune in on Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. for information, analysis, and views that are frequently ignored or distorted in other media. Guests analyze national and international issues. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesdays 2 to 3 p.m. on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and online at kpfk.org.
Support from the production of Economic Update comes in part from Democracy at Work, a nonprofit 501c3 organization and publisher of books by Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University, has authored numerous books on the subject of social economics, including Rethinking Marxism, Understanding Capitalism, and Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Further information is available at democracyatwork.info and rdwolff.com.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Before jumping in today's very interesting program with my guest, Wilmer Leon, whom I'll introduce in the second half, the topics we're going to discuss this morning in the first half are two topics. One short, one long. The short one is about a strike in Philadelphia, a union election before a strike, but a strike is coming and you'll see why. And the second topic is tariffs, because President Trump insists on using tariffs more often, on more adversaries. We used to call them allies, but when you hit them with a tariff, they become an adversary. And Mr. Trump is doing a great deal of that as fast as he can, days into his second term. So let's get to it. The Whole Foods chain that many of you know about has, of course, stores in many parts of the United States, including Philadelphia. At one of the Whole Foods stores in Philadelphia, the workers petitioned for and signed the cards needed to arrange for an election supervised by the National Labor Relations Board, in which all the eligible workers at that store could vote yes, they do want a union, or no, they do not. This is the way many unions in many workplaces come into existence. This was established almost a century ago during the 1930s. And the workers in this election had this election, and 130 voted in favor of unionization, 100 against. So there was a very clear margin in favor of joining the union. The margin of victory of the workers who wanted a union versus those who didn't was much greater than the 1.5% margin that Mr. Trump achieved over Kamala Harris. And the workers joined a particular union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and they named their union Local 1776 in honor of that important year in the history of Philadelphia and the United States. Having won by so decisive a margin, the workers there expected to be officially recognized by the NLRB, which is what is supposed to happen if and when you win the election. However, the lawyers for Amazon, let's remember, Amazon is one of the biggest corporations on earth. They have an enormous amount of money with which they buy the best lawyers money can buy. Lawyers for Amazon have now filed motions to deny the NLRB to stop it from ruling. Why? They gave two reasons. One was that some election rules were violated. The union denies this. This is kind of routine. Companies that don't want a union do this sort of thing in the hopes that they can win in front of the NLRB. As you'll see, that's what the Amazon folks clearly expect. But there was a second reason. The NLRB now lacks a quorum. It lacks enough members on the board to make these kinds of decisions. They have to have a minimum number of people sitting on the board, a quorum. Why do they lack a quorum? Well, it turns out that in the very short time that Mr. Trump has been president, he fired one board member. Who did he fire? Gwynne Wilcox, the only black member of the NLRB. And he replaced her with no one, thereby depriving the NLRB of the ability to make decisions, even routine decisions like this. And finally, lawyers working for Amazon, Starbucks, and other mega corporations like that have a lawsuit going challenging the very existence of the National Labor Relations Board. And my guess is they're hoping this will go to a Supreme Court that is mostly pro-Trump, and they will get the end of the NLRB, so there will never be again, they hope, a union that goes through the democratic procedures, has a vote, wins the election, and then can't go anywhere. Here's what we see then. A system set up so that if a democratic vote yields an outcome corporations and the governments they control don't like, well, then they have ways of avoiding, evading, squashing the democratic vote. And what's the lesson? The lesson is the one that Karl Marx taught us about, the class struggle that is endemic to the core of capitalism. Since it organizes every factory, store, and office, almost every one, into an opposition between the owner, the operator, the board of directors, on the one hand, a tiny minority, and the mass of the workers, the majority, so that more profit can be gained the more the employer squeezes the worker. This is a recipe for trouble, anger, bitterness, unions, strikes, all of it. You get capitalism, you get this. And these violations of democracy are something the companies have to resort to, and the government politicians they can control have to resort to it also. All we're seeing in Philadelphia at the Whole Foods store is one of the little moments that are happening across the country all the time, and especially now with a revived labor movement pushing. It's important to understand. Trump is hitting everybody and his brother with tariffs. Canada, Mexico, China. Now, in addition, Europe and the whole world. Anybody who has a tariff against the United States will be now hit by a tariff from the United States. And let me remind everyone what a tariff is. It's a tax. Trump is becoming the most tax-using Republican leader in the history of the Republican Party. Remember, the Republicans used to be the people always against taxes. Now, tariffs are a kind of tax. A tariff is a tax on something imported into the United States from outside. Just a tax. We have sales taxes, income taxes, and we have import taxes, which have a special name, tariffs. So here are the goals Mr. Trump enunciates. The tariffs are going to raise revenue. Taxes is what they do. They raise revenue. Why would he be interested in raising revenue? Because he wants the tax cuts from 2017, mammoth tax cuts, one of the biggest tax cut bills ever that helped mostly corporations and the rich. They expire this year, 2025. He wants to continue them. That means all that revenue which stopped coming to the government will continue not to be available to the government, which can't function, so he has to raise taxes somewhere else. And he's choosing to do it on tariffs. Why? Because he could look like the big tough leader who is smiting everybody else to raise money for the government, which can't get it any other way. And the second purpose of tariffs, he says, is to lead companies making things abroad and shipping them back home, you know, like Apple computers, things like that. He doesn't want them to make jobs overseas and bring them here. So by hitting them with a tariff, the plan is to do what they call reshoring, bringing the production of these goods back to the United States, cross the shore back in to provide jobs. So he's going to raise money and he's going to provide jobs. Two good things every president always tells us he's doing, whether he is or not. However, this makes no sense, as much of what Mr. Trump promises doesn't. Let me show you. If the companies come back, if we have reshoring, if they stop producing out there, which he says he wants, well, then they won't be bringing stuff in because they'll be producing it here. And if they don't bring the stuff in, there won't be any revenue from import duties, will there? There won't be application of tariff because the goods aren't coming in anymore. They're produced here. So if you reshore, you don't get revenue from a tariff. On the other hand, if you do get revenue from a tariff, if the companies producing abroad agree to pay the tariff, that's a tax put on the import by Uncle Sam that's paid to Uncle Sam, if he gets the revenue, it's because they didn't reshore, they didn't bring production back home. So it's internally contradictory. If you reshore, you don't get much revenue, and if you get a lot of revenue, it means you're not reshoring. Getting a lot of revenue and bringing lots of jobs here ain't going to happen because they're contradictory. But let me go further because it's important. Why will there be no reshoring, or not much? It costs a lot of money to take a production facility overseas and bring it back home. It's also a question, will Mr. Trump, who's very volatile, who does one thing one day, nullifies it the next day, goes back to it a week later, you don't know whether you're going to undertake an enormous expense only to discover a month or a year later that it wasn't necessary? You wasted all that money? Wow. Then also, if it works, if a lot of people buy the goods from abroad but at least pay the tariff, then those goods cost more in the United States and we'll have an inflation. It doesn't work. It's not thought through. This is theater instead of real solutions. And so my advice is, turn the channel. Nothing's going to happen here because this is all for show. We've come to the end of the first half of today's show. Please stay with us. I think you'll find my guests very, very interesting. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's Economic Update. It is with real pleasure that I bring for the first time to our microphones and cameras Dr. William J. Leon III, who hosts the podcast Connecting the Dots. He is a political scientist who concentrates on Black politics, American government, and public policy. For 11 years, he taught political science at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He teaches now at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. In addition, Dr. Leon is a nationally broadcast radio talk show host on Sirius XM satellite radio channel 126. He's also a nationally syndicated columnist and a regular commentator on news programs globally. So first of all, Wilmer Leon, welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure and honor for me to join you today. Thank you for the invitation. Looking forward to the conversation.
All right. I've heard you speak. I've been on your show. I've read what you've written. So I want to jump right into something I know you think about, you follow, and you have something to teach us. Last month, there was the announcement of the so-called DeepSeek achievement in terms of the whole artificial intelligence movement or revolution, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. It shook up Wall Street. I believe NVIDIA lost $600 billion worth of its shares, stock. And it brought, once again, this perennial topic that absorbs us more and more, the competition, the relationship between China on the one hand and the United States on the other. Tell me a little bit about how you understand that announcement, the whole DeepSeek phenomena, as it's now called, and its effects, particularly on China and the U.S.
Well, you know, the first thing that struck me was the timing of the announcement. It was, in my opinion, it was a clear shot across the bow of the United States. And situations or events like this, they always make me chuckle because China is just always so strategic. China does not do anything by accident. President Xi Jinping, Wang Yi, the foreign minister, they are so calculating and strategic in what they do. As much as the United States tries to bait them into responses or bait them into actions, they never take the bait. It was announced on the day of Trump's inauguration, resulting in this, as you mentioned, this tech sell-off and these much wider concerns regarding Silicon Valley's overconfidence and, might I even say, overindulgence, because it's much more open source than other models. It has the ability, this DeepSeek AI has the ability to distill advanced reasoning capabilities from massive computer models into smaller, more efficient counterparts. I think they call this compact performance. It's another indicator or another indication of the shift in the geopolitical landscape from the unitary hegemon for which the United States has been the leader or the unitary hegemon post-World War II to this now ever-growing multipolar dynamic as evidenced by the BRICS. The other thing is you've got this number of these so-called brilliant venture capitalists. I think they should now have to answer a lot of questions. I mean, they had people investing billions into the development of this product over a number of years. And all of a sudden, this competitor, was able to develop in less than a year and less than $6 million. Their solution, as I said earlier, is an open system, and it just needs a fraction of the computing power to operate and use. I think this is a game changer.
All right. This brings me to a question we have dealt with on this show before. It seems that every time China makes this kind of a strategic breakthrough, the following story emerges from the United States, in which this is not a technical advance we should all celebrate in the march of technology into the future. Clearly, the Chinese made use of things developed in the United States, as indeed more and more developments in the United States make use of things achieved in China. None of that is stressed. Instead, a story is told in which China is an aggressor. That word is used over and over again. We here in the United States are the good guys being aggressed by this China, which wants to, and then the voice trails off as if we are all supposed to know what it is that this evil Chinese. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here? Is this just the effort of an American empire being out-competed, whether it's in solar panels or electric vehicles, or now AI search procedures and so on, and you hear the belly aching of the competitive loser? Or is there something else going on here?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One, first of all, I don't think the U.S. is losing the competition. I think the U.S. has lost the competition. And what you continue to hear in the United States response to me is projection. It's projecting its own mindset and mentality onto China. The United States is a failing empire, and it's grasping at anything that it can for survival. And there's the adage that the last kicks of a dying mule are the most dangerous. To your point, the United States should be celebrating these types of advancements. But all it knows is militarism, especially since it has deindustrialized its economy, and its major export is weaponry. So all it really knows to do is stoke fear and confrontation in order to feed the savage beast known as the military-industrial complex. I think also arrogance plays an incredible role in all of this. It takes me back to the meeting in Anchorage, Alaska, during the Biden administration. And Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State at the time, was meeting with the Chinese delegation, and they had to get up from the table and tell Tony Blinken, look, we're not going to sit here and let you lecture us. We're China, damn it. We're not going to let you talk to us this way. And they got up and walked out. So I think arrogance plays a major role in this. I heard Minister Farrakhan say once, he was discussing the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and he said, you don't see with your eyes, you see with a combination of your heart and your mind, and your arrogance blinds you to making it impossible for you to properly assess the realities that are right before you. So if your only weapon is a missile, then every action or every confrontation is that of an enemy.
Where do you see this China-U.S. conflict? I mean, it seems now everywhere. When Mr. Trump was pressed to justify, as if he could, the idea that the United States is going to, quote unquote, take back the Panama Canal, one of the arguments was that somehow the United States is being cheated by the rates that are being charged, and the devious hand of the Chinese are behind, you're beginning to wonder, you know, are we going to blame China for the fires in California? Are we going to blame them for, you know, icy streets in the Midwest? Has this become the kind of caricature that the old Cold War was, where everything is translated into a story of the good guys, that's us, and the bad guys, whoever the enemy is?
Well, I think in terms of the U.S. narrative, yes. But one of the differences I would draw between today and the Cold War is that now there are a lot more players on the field. And so, and BRICS is the example of that. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and what about 14 other countries now? Something like 70% of the world's population is now in BRICS. So now, whereas during the Cold War, that was a fight between the United States and the Soviet Union, and you had two nuclear peer competitors. Now the United States, the balance of power has shifted, and it hasn't shifted in favor of the United States. So to a great degree, the United States can't scare anybody. The United States can't bully anybody, not nearly to the degree that it used to, because there are other options available to the smaller countries that would have folded by now, like Venezuela, as it relates to the sanctions regime, or Iran would have folded by now in years ago. But they don't have to acquiesce to the pressure, because there are other offsets available.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of a story I read in a French newspaper this last week, which was commenting on Trump's attacks on Canada, mm-hmm. by saying China has a limitless demand for energy. The biggest thing Canada exports to the U.S. is oil and gas, and they will send it to China. They have a, you know, they have a common ports on the Pacific Ocean. They can go from Canada to China. That will not be a problem. And the end result is the bullying and the bluster will end up isolating the United States, almost in economically, in the way that the relationship with Israel seems to isolate it politically in the world.
Well, that's what India did as it related to Russia. And when Joe Biden told us he was going to turn the ruble into rubble and he put all these sanctions on Russian oil, India said, we'll take it. China said, we'll take it. And the United States kicked Russia out of the SWIFT system, and they said, well, we'll trade in yuan and rubles. We'll trade. So again, the world has this is a truly evidence of the adage, necessity is the mother of invention.
And also, this is why you say it's a kind of historic inflection point or a historic shift here.
There is no question that we have moved away from the unitary or unipolar to the multi, and we're not going back.
What would you propose would be a better way for the U.S. to deal with China?
Cooperation. Cooperation is to me the answer to that question. The U.S. continues to shoot itself in the foot by thinking it can sanction its way to dominance and control. And this artificial intelligence issue reaffirms again the adage that necessity is the mother of invention. The U.S. Alleged controls on highly advanced microchips. That was supposed to limit the resources available to China. And what did they do? They just made their own.
Wilmer Leon, thank you very, very much. As always, we're just getting started and the time is up.
Thank you, Richard.
I hope you'll consider coming back.
Anytime.
And resuming this conversation. But on behalf of all my audience, thank you very much for your insights. And to all of you, as usual, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Support from the production of Economic Update comes in part from Democracy at Work, a nonprofit 501c3 organization and publisher of books by Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University, has authored numerous books on the subject of social economics, including Rethinking Marxism, Understanding Capitalism, and Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Further information